From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. In a world full of war and violence, it's hard not to conclude that humanity is a nasty piece of work. But the world is also full of random acts of kindness, saints and heroes. So, which are we? Inherently good or naturally bad? And where do we look for answers? To religion?
Confucius was one of the first people to define the golden rule when he was asked, Master, which of your teachings can we put into practice all day and every day? And what's the central thread that runs through all your teachings? He said, Shu, which means likening to the self. Never treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself.
Historian Karen Armstrong says religion evolved to help people learn to control their selfish tendencies so they could live together. Sam Harris finds a better moral compass in science.
The biggest moral problems we face as a civilization, stopping nuclear proliferation and the causes of war and pandemic disease and climate change, none of this falls outside the purview of rationality generally or science specifically.
And primatologist Vanessa Woods discovers the key to human nature in our closest ape cousins. So reject your inner chimp. Learn to channel the bonobo within.
We all know intellectually that it would be great not to kill each other and not to hurt each other, but still the level of violence in the world today, and even in America and even in our own neighborhoods, is just extraordinary. And bonobos don't have it, and we need to find out why and how.
But first, if you really want to understand human behavior, forget about psychology. Take a look at economics. Is it self-interest all the way, or can business be a force for good? Ron Shaikh is the founder of the Panera Bread Company, a highly successful chain of restaurants. He's come up with a rather astonishing new business model. Cafes where customers pay only what they want to or can afford to. Shaikh calls them the Panera Cares Cafes. So why would the CEO of a company with over 1,400 stores and $2.8 billion in annual sales step down to run what amounts to a social experiment?
The way customers pay is they put it into a donation box. One of the things that we felt is if we're going to really be straight on this, we couldn't have a cash register. We had to deal with making certain that we didn't put so much psychological pressure on people that those in need wouldn't come in. I can tell you this, Jim. We had a vision for this, a vision for what these cafes would be. And then along the way, we changed everything in developing it. And that's what entrepreneurs do. You have a vision, and then you try to figure out how to get there. And that's what built Panera, and that's what is building the Panera Cares Cafes.
So tell me about the first one. Where did you start?
Oh, we started the first one in Clayton, Missouri. We're now 1,500 cafes, close to 1,500. This was one of our original 10 cafes. We wanted a cafe that was economically eclectic. We needed to have people that could benefit from it. And we also needed to be in a neighborhood where there are people that could support it. And so this is a community where there's both million-dollar townhouses two blocks away and the county courthouse and county jail across the street. This is a neighborhood in which there are people that are out running in the mornings and also folks that may be panhandling in the afternoon.
So tell me about that first day. What was it like when you opened up?
It was a great test of humanity. I mean, the real question was, were people going to abuse this? I think there was a fear that people would see it as lunch on Uncle Ron, lunch on Panera,
Sure.
And is this going to be a place that people could abuse and game? It was really a test of humanity. That was test number one. And test number two, the other reason we wanted to do it was we wanted to say to other companies out there, step up and you can do more than just give a check. Yeah. If we can figure out how to take the skills of other public companies like Panera and utilize them for the public good, that is a valuable resource.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a pretty astonishing thing, and I guess I'm just trying to get at what it was like that first day. You must have done some advanced publicity. You told
them. No. Actually, it's the opposite.
Oh,
really? We wanted nobody to know about it.
You wanted nobody to know. So people walked in expecting to see prices.
The first issue we had, fascinating, as people began to walk in, was, okay, we have these donation boxes. People don't know what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine you've had 10, 15, 20,000 opportunities to walk into a restaurant where you look at a menu board and people tell you what to spend. So I got out there and I started talking to people and I started getting other what we call greeters to talk to people. And we began to have to take every customer through the system. And what we would say to people is, welcome to Panera Cares, our cafe of shared responsibility. This is Panera's gift to the community. We need to sustain this. If we're able to sustain this, we're going to take the resources we generate and use it basically to help at-risk kids. If there are no set prices here, if you have a couple extra dollars in your pocket, feel free to leave the suggested retail price or more.
So just to be clear, you tell people what it would cost if they were at a regular Panera store. So they have some idea. I mean, you know whether this is a $5 sandwich or $6.50 or whatever.
Exactly. On the other hand, we also say to people, right in that greeting, if you don't have the money in your pocket, please feel free to take a discount or frankly leave nothing in our donation bin. What we're asking of you as a guest is to do the right thing.
So what was it like that first week? Did people pay?
It was an emotional roller coaster. The facts are that 20% of customers have left more than the suggested retail. That's what they do. About 60% of customers leave the suggested retail. And about 20% of customers leave less than suggested retail. But the ones that leave less than suggested retail leave relatively less than those that leave more. So that net, on average, people are leaving about 80% of the retail price.
This is not a bad business model, is it?
It's not a business model. And I'll explain to you what I mean by that. What fuels this and allows this to exist, and I think it gets partially to your question of are people good, is people don't want to be used and they don't want to be gamed. People are fundamentally good if they feel like they are not being abused and they're not being taken advantage of and taken for fools. And the key to this is that it is legitimately in a nonprofit foundation. Panera is not benefiting in any way from it. The key to this is the transparency that we share with the community. And so I think that this works because people trust it. Yeah. People believe in it. And if we in any way violate it, or if in any way it's perceived as people being used or gamed, this doesn't work.
You know, it's the same on both ends of that equation, though, isn't it? I can see that that some people would come in and game the system. That I could see high school kids, for instance, coming in and figuring, and hey, free lunch.
Well, you know, Jim, it's exactly what was so tough those first couple of weeks. That first day, I remember this gentleman who walked in, and he said to me, I know you're one of the guys running this place. He said, let me tell you a story. 3 months ago, I was a tech writer, and I'm a big Panera fan. I lost my job, and my kids haven't been out to eat in 3 months. In fact, truth of the matter is the three kids that are with me today, we don't know where we're going to eat tonight. I don't know where we're going to get the money for food. Can we eat here? You get it. And you realize that with near 10% unemployment, with one out of six kids living in homes with food instability in the last year, this isn't a problem simply of the poor and the poverty-stricken. This is a problem in many of our middle-class communities. And the opportunity to help and touch a gentleman like that makes you feel so good. And our own people get excited about it because they themselves have been through it. On the other hand, Jim, right after you have that, I'm working the counter and I have a local high school kid actually who walks in and says, I'll have three sandwiches and two smoothies. And by the way, here's my dad's credit card. Put $3 on it. I wanted to jump across the counter and string that kid up around the neck. Now, here's the problem we have, right? You know, we can't judge people on their dress. We can't have a 1099 check at the door. We ultimately have to trust people to do the right thing, and we have to get to them and help them to think about what the right thing is and to understand their responsibilities to each other.
Panera Bread Company founder Ron Shake is running a new chain of nonprofit restaurants where payment is voluntary. There are currently 3 Panera Cares cafes, and Shake has plans for many more. For centuries, people looked to religion for moral boundaries. Priests and rabbis and imams were the people you turned to if you had questions about sin and salvation, good and evil, and how to tell one from the other. In the future, maybe we'll get better answers from people in lab coats. Sam Harris is a prominent atheist who trained as a neuroscientist. In his new book, The Moral Landscape, he argues that science, not religion, should determine human values. Harris told Steve Paulson that there are right and wrong answers to moral questions, and they're found in science.
The irony, from my point of view, is that the people who tend to agree with me at a first pass are religious demagogues. The only people in our culture at this moment who are absolutely sure there are right answers to moral questions, for the most part, are people who think the universe is 6,000 years old and they got these answers from a voice in a whirlwind. But the problem with getting your morality out of religion is that it separates moral thinking from the actual details of human and animal suffering. And so, for instance, you look at an institution like the Catholic Church. This is an institution that is more concerned about preventing contraception than about preventing the rape of children. It's more concerned about preventing gay marriage than genocide or nuclear proliferation or any other hugely consequential problem.
Those are highly debatable assertions you've just made.
They're actually not debatable at the level of what it spends its time doing and at the level of its actual doctrine. The child rape versus contraception issue is just not debatable. People get excommunicated for preaching contraception. Women get excommunicated for attempting to become priests, but the church does not excommunicate priests for raping children. That the church didn't excommunicate a single member of the Third Reich for genocide, and yet it excommunicated Joseph Goebbels for marrying a Protestant. I mean, this is a diabolical inversion of priorities if your priority is human flourishing. And I'm saying the moment you see that our priorities have to be the flourishing of any conscious creature that can flourish, and this is what we must mean by morality, then when the Catholic Church talks about the moral peril of contraception, we can say that they're misusing the word. They're not offering a framework, an alternate framework of morality that we have to take seriously. They're offering a false one. I mean, they could talk about physics, too. They could talk about the physics of the transubstantiation or the physics that permits the Holy Ghost to be everywhere at once. But they would be misusing the term physics, and it would be the responsibility of any physicist to say, that's not physics. What I'm saying is the moment we admit that a maturing science of the human mind is going to begin to talk intelligently about all of the variables that influence human well-being, we're going to have to admit that some people have no idea what is worth paying attention to in this world and are using words in ways that are useless or worse.
Well, I don't know that we want to get into a big discussion about the morality of the Catholic Church, but of course there is an entirely different strand that you have not referred to, and that's all of those Catholics who have gone into poor areas of the world, who've devoted their lives to trying to help people, especially to help the downtrodden. I mean, that's an enormous thrust of many Catholics.
I wouldn't deny that for a moment. I mean, obviously people do heroically good things in the name of religion and guided by their faith. But what I would argue is that religion gives people bad reasons to be good where good reasons are available. And having bad reasons behind what you're doing, albeit very good work, often has terrible consequences. So you have Christian missionaries, not just Catholics, but Christians who go into the developing world, go into sub-Saharan Africa, and genuinely feed people and genuinely feel compassion for their suffering. And all of that's to the good. But then, because they're saddled with a variety of dogmas, they do really idiotic and dangerous things, like preach the sinfulness of condom use in villages decimated by AIDS, or they preach the necessity of believing in the divinity of Jesus in communities where Christian-Muslim violence has literally led to the death of millions. And so what I'm saying is that it's obviously a very good thing to go to Africa and heal the sick and feed the hungry, but you can answer that call based purely on a compassionate connection to the suffering of other human beings. And people do this. Groups like Doctors Without Borders manage to do this without believing anything on insufficient evidence.
Mm-hmm. Now, some years back, the biologist Stephen Jay Gould argued that facts and values are in fundamentally different realms, what he called non-overlapping magisteria. And Gould said that science deals with the empirical world of fact and theory, while questions about moral meaning and value fall within the religious realm. Was he just wrong in making this dichotomy?
Yes, he was, and we are suffering the consequences of that error in many respects, because that has been the currency of that idea is still remarkable, and it's been received as just this crucial insight into the nature of our intellectual life.
And I know a lot of scientists who accept that dichotomy.
It's truly indefensible when you look at the details, and it'll take me just 2 minutes to expose those details. Clearly, his main point was that science and religion represent different areas of expertise, and they just treat different aspects of reality. And that's just obviously untrue when you look at what every religious doctrine purports to be true. And so you look at Christianity, for instance. Every serious Christian believes that Jesus was born of a virgin, rose from death, now exists in some form where he can hear people's thoughts and respond to prayers from time to time, and will be coming back to judge the living and the dead at some point in human history. Now, you can say there are Christians who don't quite believe that, but most serious Christians believe something very much like that. All of these claims are proto-scientific claims. I mean, these are, you know, the virgin birth is a claim about biology.
I can see your critique of sort of the religion part of this, the idea that religion only cares about morality and doesn't make truth claims. Obviously, religion does make truth claims. It's a little unclear to me, the other side of this equation, how science really can tell us how to live better, how science can be the basis of morality. Certainly rationality is. I mean, that's kind of what
right.
modern civilization is
right.
based on. I'm not clear where science fits into that. I mean, neuroscience and, you know, evolutionary biology, those kinds of things.
Right. Well, there's one distinction that we should have in view is because it leads to a little bit of confusion here. We have to distinguish between answers in practice and answers in principle, because there are many things that there are many scientific truths, and in fact, an infinite number of scientific facts that exist, but we're never going to find them in practice. I mean, it's just, you know, if I asked you how many birds are in flight over the surface of the Earth at this moment, you don't know, I don't know, and no team of scientists could possibly know. There's no Manhattan Project that's going to deliver that information, and yet we know this is a well-posed question that has a very simple answer. It's just a number. And we conduct science and we ask questions about the nature of reality against a background of facts that we know we're never going to uncover, and it would be practically impossible to do so. And yet they're real facts. They're real truths, and it's possible to be right or wrong about them. And if I said, well, actually, Steve, I know there are 15 birds in flight over the surface of the Earth at this moment, you would know that that's a highly implausible guess. And if anything depended on that being right, you wouldn't put any weight on it. Now, one thing I can grant you is that there are some problems in human affairs that are so fantastically complicated that we may never understand them scientifically. But that doesn't mean there are not right and wrong answers that would be scientifically true if we could find them.
Give me one or two examples of how a science-based view of morality can actually help us unravel some difficult moral problems out there.
Well, for instance, you can ask a very simple question. You know, how should you discipline children? You know, there are 21 states in which it is legal to beat children with a wooden board in their schools. And I don't mean just rapping their knuckles with a ruler. I mean really flogging them with a large wooden paddle so hard as to cause real bruising and breaking the skin. Now, so you can ask a very simple question. Is subjecting children to pain and public humiliation a good way to discipline them? And what are the outcomes psychologically and socially when you do this? Now, whatever is true there, there are right and wrong answers here, clearly. I mean, it clearly matters how we treat children. And it is good to treat them kindly or not based on the outcome of treating them that way and based on what kind of society it creates and based on their experience and your experience doing it and your intentions, the full gestalt of human intention and emotion and whether we flourish together or not in that circumstance. And we can understand that scientifically. Every other question of interest to us about how we can improve our lives in this world is of that character. And granted, some are really complicated and some involve trade-offs between, how do you weight one person's well-being over another's in any instance? And there are situations where there are trade-offs, but clearly the best solutions don't tend to be zero-sum. I mean, the biggest moral problems we face as a civilization, you know, stopping nuclear proliferation and the causes of war and pandemic disease and climate change, I mean, and educating people well, all of these things are good for everybody. There are no obvious trade-offs there, and there are clearly things we want to do, and for good reason. And so I'm just saying that none of this falls outside the purview of rationality generally or science specifically. And yes, so science and science generally, behavioral economics, neuroscience, psychology, social psychology, all of that has to be brought to bear on the kinds of decisions we make.
Sam Harris is the author of The End of Faith, Letters to a Christian Nation, and most recently, The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, which of our closest cousins do you want to be? The bonobo or the chimp?
Chimpanzees, they're just these, you know, incredible creatures, and they have these coalitions and they have war. But I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, who would I rather wake up in the morning as? I would rather wake up as a bonobo, because I would much rather protect those I love from violence at the hands of my own species.
And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Primatologists and evolutionary biologists often point to chimpanzees to explain human nature. After all, chimps share 98.7% of their DNA with us, and they're our closest living non-human relatives. Like us, chimps are intelligent, but they can also be violent and aggressive. They rape and kill, just as we do. We have another family of ape relatives, though, bonobos. They're kind of the good twins, gentle, pacifist, and matriarchal. Animal researcher Vanessa Woods has spent a lot of time studying and living with bonobos. She told Anne Strangechamps, the question we all need to ask ourselves is, which are we, chimp or bonobo?
I'm definitely a bonobo. I've spent so much time. I think I occasionally have chimpanzee flashes, but I would like to be more bonobo. I think that it would pay if more people would be bonobo people.
And what are bonobo people like compared to chimp people?
Well, you know, less not preferring to stay away from conflict, you know, trying not to be so domineering, trying not to solve situations with violence and dominance. I mean, more cooperative in general.
That sort of makes it sound like they're just better. Is there a downside to being a bonobo person?
Is there a downside? Well, I'm really biased, so you shouldn't be asking me. You should be asking like a chimp person, because they would be saying, yeah, because bonobos are like seriously boring. Because chimpanzees, they're just these, you know, incredible creatures, and they have these coalitions and they have war. But I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, who would I rather wake up in the morning as? I would rather wake up as a bonobo, because I would much rather protect those I love from violence at the hands of my own species.
Hmm. It's interesting, because there have been these debates for decades, centuries maybe, about human altruism, whether we're naturally altruistic or whether it's something that has to be taught. Does that make you think that altruism is hardwired in us?
Well, I mean, you know, Felix Varnaken did a study and saw that, you know, altruism exists in sort of 2-year-old, 18-month-old infants, you know, and they can't talk, and there's arguably they've absorbed very little culture. So, I mean, I think in some ways altruism is, I guess, if you like to say, hardwired. I think, you know, it's a combination of nature and nurture. But we're all trying to figure out what it is that makes us human, like what it is that makes us special. But I'm never surprised when people find it in our closest living relatives, because, you know, all these traits, I mean, they have to come from somewhere. I mean, we didn't just sort of spring out as this kind of blank slate. So, you know, when I see altruism in bonobos or grief in bonobos or love in bonobos, I'm not surprised at all. And anyone who has a dog knows that animals have emotions.
Mm. Why then aren't bonobos running the world? I mean, it sort of seems like it's that, you know, we became much more chimp-like than bonobo-like, and we're running the world, but what happened to all those wonderful bonobo traits?
Well, I think we are very bonobo, and in some ways we're more bonobo than bonobo, because when you talk about cooperation, when you talk about altruism, we can be wonderful, wonderful people, and you hear these stories every day about what people are doing for each other, the wonderful things we're doing for each other. And I think that in joint with, I guess, our competitive edge and striving always to be like a little bit better and get a little bit more in control, I guess the chimpanzee side is we've gotten to the way we are. I mean, the reason why bonobos aren't running the world is that they don't want to. I mean, they've got everything they need right there in the Congo Basin. They've got, you know, a lot of food, a lot of sex. I mean, why? Running the world is like a really, really stressful job. Why would you want that?
The bonobos you saw live largely just in the Congo, and those are the only bonobos in the world. They're pretty endangered. You write that if we lose the bonobos, we'll never learn their secret. What is their secret?
Is how to live in a world without violence. And I mean, you know, we are losing species everywhere. We're losing them all over the place. And sometimes people ask me, you know, what about the polar bears? Or what about this, you know, really endangered lemur in Madagascar? I mean, why should we care about bonobos more than we care for all these other species? And just the answer is that they have something that for all our intelligence and, you know, for all, I guess, a cultural advancement we haven't been able to have, and that is just a world without violence. We can't do it. We absolutely cannot do it. We know, we all know intellectually that it would be great not to kill each other and not to hurt each other, but still the level of violence in the world today, and even in America, and even in our own neighborhoods, is just extraordinary. And bonobos don't have it, and we need to find out why and how.
And what are the questions we would need to ask first to begin to figure that out?
Well, I guess, you know, the most important thing to figure out is that what are the contexts in which human violence occurs? I mean, when you hear about religious violence or racial violence, I guess there's this kind of instinct to just say, oh, it's just those kind of people. Like, nobody like me would ever behave that way. But when, I guess, you look at the biological basis for aggression, we share with chimpanzees this tendency towards violence, towards people who we think of as not like us. So I think it's really crucial to understand, to really understand and not just be afraid of it, this biological basis for aggression, why it occurs, how it occurs, so that we can put these structures in place to manage it. And, you know, in some ways we already do. We have police forces and justice systems to make sure that we can't just go out on a chimpanzee on a rampage whenever we feel like it. But, you know, there needs to be more. And bonobos, they have this mechanism to diffuse tension and to make sure there's no lethal violence. And we need to figure out more about that mechanism and how we could adopt a mechanism similar to that.
Vanessa Woods writes about her work with bonobos in a new scientific memoir called Bonobo Handshake. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. So what about you? Are you more bonobo or chimp? Join the conversation about human nature on our Facebook page or through our website at ttbook.org. Charles Darwin's theory of evolution explains a lot about human nature. How competitive we are, how quick to seize the advantage, how selfish we can be. But if evolution is a game called survival of the fittest, how do you explain altruism? Now, the answer to that question lies in a mathematical theorem. It's called the altruism equation, and it was discovered by a remarkable man named George Price. He was a brilliant maverick who worked in multiple scientific fields, but in his later life he gave all his possessions away to the poor, became homeless, and eventually committed suicide. Orrin Harmon tells the story in a biography called The Price of Altruism. He told Steve Paulson that George Price wanted to know why, if it really is a dog-eat-dog world, people help each other.
This was a very serious conundrum. It was a problem. And Darwin said, if I cannot solve this problem, my theory is worthless. And ever since Darwin, different kinds of scientists, geneticists, mathematical population biologists, ecologists, behavioral scientists, economists, psychologists, and so forth, have been trying to crack this problem.
Yeah. Well, let's bring a fascinating character into the story. And you have written a book about him, George Price, a mathematician. Tell me how he figures into this story.
Well, George is really a cinematic character. He's kind of a cross between a Forrest Gump and a Rain Man. Born in New York City in 1922, killed himself in a squat in London the winter of 1975. And he's a Forrest Gump character because he found himself sort of at the center of multiple revolutions, scientific and technological revolutions in the 20th century. In each case, solving some problem and then disappearing like a phantom. People didn't really always know who he was because he didn't stick around long enough to be known. So he worked at the Manhattan Project as a chemist working on uranium enrichment at the University of Chicago, then made a 90-degree turn and began working at Bell Labs with people like Shockley and Bardeen on transistor research, then left that and turned to oncology, to cancer research, developing ways to detect cancer tumors at the University of Minnesota. Then left that completely, moved to the village, was doing a lot of drugs. While he was doing a lot of drugs, invented what later became known as computer-aided design, which is the ability to manipulate a three-dimensional object on a computer screen. So in each case, doing something really quite extraordinary, and then completely abandoning what he had done for a different pasture.
So how did he get into the study of altruism?
What happened was when he was working in Poughkeepsie at IBM, he developed a thyroid cancer and underwent an operation which was successful, or semi-successful, successful in the sense that it got rid of the cancer, but left him kind of with a shoulder and an arm which weren't entirely sort of kinetic. And it really threw him into a great depression, so much so that he came to the realization that really life was not worth living anymore. Now, by this time, he'd already abandoned his family. He left his wife and two little daughters, Anna Marie and Kathleen, who were about 4 and 5 when he left them back in Minnesota. And he decided that he was not only going to totally abandon his family, but he was going to leave his job, leave his country, and have a crack at one last great sort of problem before leaving this world. And the problem that he chose was, funnily enough, the evolution of family.
Someone who has just abandoned his own family.
Right. I mean, George, having abandoned his family, decided that what he really wanted to figure out was how family had come about as a unit in evolution. And so, against the good wishes of all his friends, he got on a boat and sailed across the Atlantic to England. This is November 1967. And from some of the money that he had from the insurance from the botched operation, took an apartment close to Oxford Circus in London, and began reading the relevant papers, technical papers, in the evolutionary literature in the late opening public libraries of London, 13 of them. So he was sort of like a, you know, he went to one library until he was kicked out, went to another and so forth. Complete outsider. No one knew him. As I said, he was very, very down in the doldrums, depressed, hardly left his home except for to go to the library. And he came across a paper, the famous paper, written by Bill Hamilton, the father of the notion of kin selection, and decided that, looked at the mathematics. Now, he really didn't understand it to begin with, because as brilliant as George was, he hadn't trained either as a mathematician or as a biologist. He had no training in evolutionary theory. But he sensed that the important person in the field was this guy Hamilton, and so he wrote him a letter saying, hello, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is George Price, and I've come to solve the problem that you're working on. And Hamilton, who was on his way to the jungles of Brazil to study social wasps, was an English gentleman and had no idea who this American, this strange American was, but wrote back saying, you know, good luck, here's a reprint, and I wish you the best of luck. And about 5 months later, when Hamilton returned to London, he found on his desk what became known as the Price equation, and almost immediately recognized that this was a very, very important mathematical equation when it came to the evolution of altruism. Now, a month earlier, when George had written the equation, he too sensed immediately that this was an important equation.
So what was the Price equation?
Right. So what the equation basically did, it was a rewriting of Hamilton's mathematics. Hamilton claimed that altruism could only evolve between genetically related individuals. What George's equation showed was that that wasn't true, that it could evolve between like-minded, so to speak, individuals that needn't be genetically related to one another. In other words, it could evolve by association rather than by genetic relatedness. So this was the equation. It was actually very, very short. It's a very short and beautiful mathematical tautology. It's a theorem. It's always true. And George immediately recognized this and walked off the street, as I said, a complete outsider, into the biostatistics department at University College London and asked for the professor. Knocked on his door, again, said, "Hello, I'm George Price. Have a look at this equation. Is it new?" And within about a matter of minutes, he was given keys to an office and an honorary professorship at what was then one of the best genetics centers in the world. So very unusual. And then he went home, George did, and began thinking about what had just happened. And like I said before, he was sort of a Rain Man character, meaning that he was probably somewhere on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, a very, very high-functioning autist, perhaps. And numbers meant a lot to him. He was very numerical. He thought of this sort of miraculous equation as a kind of coincidence. It seemed to him very strange that of all the great minds ever since Darwin, he, of all people, should have come up with this equation because he, you know, he came out of nowhere. He had no training. And so he began to think of other coincidences that had happened to him in his life, and he multiplied them. Very strange coincidences, by the way. Things like he'd had four girlfriends whose name was Anne. Or the last four digits of his phone number were 2399, which to him signified a moment before midnight, a moment before kingdom come. And the number he came up with was astronomical, 1 divided by 10 to the 30th, meaning that the chance that all these coincidences should have happened to him was minuscule, and yet they all had happened to him. And so, being a rationalist, he did the only thing that he rationally thought he could do, which was to run out of his apartment on Little Titchfield Street directly into the church at All Souls at Langham, and on the spot became an evangelical Christian, having concluded that he must have been chosen by God, because of the numbers, to tell some great truth to humanity, namely, where kindness had come from.
Wow. This has to be one of the strangest stories of religious conversion I've ever heard.
You know, it's actually interesting. When I was researching this book, I found out that, in fact, this is quite a well-trodden path to religious enlightenment, where complete skeptics are drawn to God via sort of probability arguments and numbers. But of course, most people who undergo this kind of conversion are not as unusual as George, because George did some pretty unusual things in his life.
Well, and then the story takes a more tragic turn. He ended up giving away all of his possessions, essentially lived the life of a derelict. I mean, here's this man who was obviously brilliant, had just been given this professorship at one of the top universities in the world, and ended up living on the street.
Well, what happened was that after the conversion, George began to think philosophically about the equation. And the way he thought about this, and this, it's important to say that his conclusion was not necessarily a logical conclusion, but he thought that if he was able to write a mathematical equation that explains something like the origin of kindness or the origin of altruism, what it meant about kindness or altruism was that, in fact, they were never pure and genuine. In other words, there was always some interest behind the action which was responsible for the evolution of the action.
Always some self-interest.
Exactly. So basically that kindness is, in fact, always a form of disguised self-interest. Now, this was a terrible realization for a Christian, because what it meant was that the best the natural process could do was a kind of, you know, second-rate kindness, second-rate altruism, not a real, pure, genuine one in the form of the kind of love that Jesus preached for. And so George wasn't going to take this lying down. In fact, he decided that he was going to show via his own actions that his own mathematics, the kind of miraculous mathematics that he himself had described, could be transcended by the human spirit. In other words, that the human spirit could transcend the natural process and really come up with true, genuine kindness, even though the evolutionary process couldn't do it on its own. And so he began a program of radical altruism, the end of which was to give away everything, to be truly, genuinely selfless. And so it began sort of slowly by going out to the homeless derelicts of London, introducing himself, "Hi, my name is George, how can I help you? Here's a pound, here's £5, here's a sandwich." And then it graduated quite quickly to something more radical. They were living in his home. And he was literally giving them money, giving away everything that he had. And at one point, there's a letter that I found in the archive where he writes to John Maynard Smith, a great evolutionist of the age, "John, I'm down to my last 15p and I can't wait to give it away." Because what it meant to George was that he was succeeding. His actions were proving that the mathematics could be beaten down, that they could be transcended.
It's almost as if, yeah, as if he wanted to transcend his own equation, his own solution to the altruism problem.
That's right. That's right. And of course, you can figure out what the end will be. I mean, in this sense, it really is a tragedy. You can't really stop it because he lost everything, gave away everything, and became a vagabond himself, just like one of the vagabonds that he had set out to save. And so at one point, he had to leave his home, began living rough in the streets at Euston Square in the train station, in different squats, was down to skin and bones. And George took his life in a very gruesome fashion with a pair of scissors to his carotid artery in a squat in Kentish Town in the beginning of January 1975.
Let me come back to that question that George Price posed. Can kindness ever be pure?
I think that it's not really that important what the motivation behind an act of kindness is. I mean, it's interesting, but focusing on that may not be where we should be focusing. Maybe we should return to the biological definition and focus on the result. You know, if a lot of people did a lot of good things towards others, the world would be a better place, and it wouldn't really matter all that much whether they did it for reasons that had to do with their own well-being or for their own self-interest. When Bill Gates decides to give away half of his money, I don't really care why he did it, to be written into the history books so that he could feel good about himself for reasons of respect and self-aggrandizement. It doesn't really matter. What matters is where that money goes to do good in the world towards others. I think that in a sense, George teaches us that lesson because of his grim ending. He failed to understand that and paid a price. But we can look at his life and learn from it.
Orrin Harmon's the author of The Price of Altruism, George Price and the Search for the Origins of Kindness. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Later this hour, Altruism and the Golden Rule.
When Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, was asked to sum up the whole of Jewish teaching while he stood on one leg, he said, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the Torah, and everything else is only commentary."
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Religious historian Karen Armstrong doesn't like the either-or, good-evil dichotomy. She believes we're hardwired to be selfish and to be kind, and that most of us spend our lives trying to tame our brutal instincts with our better selves. Luckily, she says, we have a powerful tool at our disposal. Compassion. Karen Armstrong has written more than 20 books on the subject of what Christianity, Judaism, and Islam have in common. In 2009, she unveiled her Charter for Compassion, and she's just written a new book called 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. She told Anne Strainchamps that compassion is the cornerstone of all the major religions. That's why it's called the Golden Rule.
Every single one of the major world religions has evolved its own version of this golden rule and claimed that it is the central pivot of faith, the test of true spirituality. When Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, was asked to sum up the whole of Jewish teaching while he stood on one leg, he said, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the Torah, and everything else is only commentary." Go and study it.
Well, one of the great historical conundrums surely is, How is it that so many religions founded by leaders who preached compassion have had such trouble practicing it? You know, you look back over the history of religious violence, the Christian Crusades, the Arab-Israeli conflict, Islamic jihads. This is such an old story. Why?
Compassion's not a very popular virtue. People would often rather be right than compassionate. Compassion requires you to put your ego on the back burner. And people really don't want to do that. A lot of people like to use religion to enhance their sense of identity and to make them feel good about themselves. And one of the ways of doing that is to say, I'm right and everybody else is wrong.
Mm. So in part, it's the old story of power corrupts. But looking back over that history, you really have to wonder whether violence and aggression and the will to power over others are simply part of human nature.
Certainly, we are aggressive animals. And in my book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, I look at the neurology of the brain, right at the center of the brain, the oldest part of our brain we inherited from our reptilian ancestors who crawled out of the primal slime millions of years ago. And without these aggressive instincts that are instinctive and immediate, we wouldn't have survived. Neuroscientists call the drives that fuel this reptilian ancient brain the four Fs: fighting, fleeing, feeding, and reproduction.
Yeah, I don't hear anything about compassion and treating your neighbors like yourself in there.
No, but you see, we went on. We evolved. The mammals developed another kind of brain on the outside, where reptiles just hatch eggs and leave their young to fend for themselves. Mammals started to care for their young, and for the first time, sentient beings were looking after other beings other than themselves. Incipient altruism was developing. We also have these centers in our brains. We're wired for compassion too and for altruism. And that means the whole human race and other species. And no matter how unpromising and disappointing our fellow human beings are, compassion means that we cannot give up on them. In Buddhism, the word compassion, karuna, means to take responsibility for the pain of all others and to resolve to end the pain of human beings and all species.
Well, it seems to me that however you answer the question, are we innately good, innately compassionate, or innately selfish, maybe has a lot of bearing on how you go about trying to foster compassion. You know, if you think that we're perhaps inherently selfish, then maybe we need rules and laws to force us to overcome our nasty instincts. If you think we're innately compassionate, then maybe it's more a matter of awakening us to our true
natures. No, I wouldn't say either of those. I think what we've got is different aspects of our complex, highly complex brains working against one another. Yes, we're selfish, and otherwise we wouldn't have survived as a species. But the religions have all stood outside this and said, if you can't keep that selfishness and egotism in check, human beings cannot live together in peace. And we also make ourselves miserable. Ego is the source of so much of our unhappiness. When we wake up at 3 a.m, when life often seems very dark, we often toss and turn and say, why has this happened to me? Why has X got this and I have nothing? And resenting all the harm that has been done to me and endless worries about our status and standing in the world. You know, the religions say, look, if you can get yourself outside this self-preoccupation, you'll be happier and more fulfilled. And also getting beyond this egotism, which imprisons us in a sort of self-obsessed world, broadens our horizons and gives us access to what we call God, Nirvana, Brahman, or Tao.
Well, one of the great advantages of all of the old religious practices or religious observances was it was a regular way to remind oneself to at least make the attempt to live by the golden rule, to at least make the attempt to become a more passionate person. We live now in an increasingly secular age. Those old daily and weekly religious observances are not part of many people's lives. In that case, how do we keep compassion front and center?
We have to work at it. Wherever I traveled in the world, east or west, north or south, people wanted to hear a more compassionate way of living and of being religious, which has tended to get lost, especially with institutions can become very sort of, hybrid and institutionalized, as it were, to get back to this inner core of compassion. But it demands hard work. As human beings, one of the things we do is to enhance and work hard at natural abilities. And we learn to run and jump to get away from our predators. And now we have ballet and gymnastics. And if you practice this all day and every day, you can achieve feats that are absolutely impossible for an untrained body and take the physical into a different dimension. And people have found throughout history in the world religions that if they practice the golden rule all day and every day, as Confucius said, not just when you feel like it or when the whim strikes you, but all day and every day, you achieve new capacities of mind and heart.
Well, so far you've described compassion as something of a struggle to overcome our baser natures and as hard work. Can it also be a joyful practice?
Yes, it can. Because when you leave yourself behind a little bit by putting someone else into the center of your world, all this misery that this rat run of the me first brain tends to fall into place more. Your mind broadens. The Buddhists see it as opening out, breaking out of the prison into which egotism traps us. And certainly, but you have to try it to do it. Just as you have to, it's no good expecting that you're going to sort of immediately pirouette onto the stage and become prima ballerina in a couple of hours. It takes a lifetime's work, and then you can achieve these wonderful feats. I'm up in the woods, I'm down on my mind, I'm building a still to slow down the time.
Karen Armstrong is an authority on comparative religions and the author of more than 20 books on the subject. In 2009, she launched the Charter for Compassion, and her most recent book is called 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. She spoke with Enstrain Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Are Humans Innately Good? Program number 116A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.